This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Jason Epstein, who is best known these days as the founder or co-founder of the Espresso Book Machine Company, but who has been an editor and publisher for many, many years. Hey, Jason, how are you?
Okay.
It's nice to be talking to you today. Can you tell me just I know you've been in the book business for a really long time. Can you give me a kind of short story version of what you've done?
Well, from the very beginning, I've been interested in backlist. That is, the books that embody our civilization. So I've always taken an evangelical attitude toward my work. It's not just a matter of selling books, it's a matter of creating and preserving a civilization. So my first job was a Doubleday. I became, when I was a trainee or an assistant editor, or whatever you call it, and this was the time of the GI Bill. My classmates at Columbia were unable to pay for the hardcover editions of the books they wanted to read, and there were no paperbacks of books of that sort. They were only cheap newsstand paperbacks.
Like the Ace kind of that 25 kind of or 10 cent.
Well, pocket books, whatever they were.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did when I went to work at Doubleday was to suggest to the person I worked for that we do the kinds of books that we were reading at Columbia in a quality paperback format that you would sell in a bookstore that wouldn't wear out in a few months but would last indefinitely. And so he said, go ahead and do it, and we printed the first 12 a year later, and they were called Anchor Books, and they caused a revolution in the industry.
How did you choose the books? The
I liked.
Just, you picked them. Was it mostly fiction, or was it all fiction?
Yeah, it was both. Some novels, some nonfiction. Edmund Wilson's book, Unto the Finland Station, which has been at print. D.H. Lawrence's Studies in Classic American Literature, which is a wonderful, indispensable book, and now, again, hard to find. And a novel by Gide, and various things like that. So that revolutionized the publishing business, and here I was, all of 21 years old. So I learned something from that, which is that my colleagues, who are for the most part charming men and women in the industry, don't really, not really enthusiastic about innovation, put it that way. So time went on, and my interest in backlist mounted, and most of the books I published at Doubleday were backlist books that survived. Some of them are still around. And for one reason or another, I decided to leave that company. And in fact, the reason was Nabokov, the president of the company at the time, a silly old man named Douglas Black, would not read the manuscript of Lolita, even though I had published a third of it without asking anybody's permission in a magazine, a quarterly magazine that I was doing in the Anchor series, and no one paid any attention to it. No one shot anybody or got arrested. Anyway, I decided that was enough of Double A. So I went to work at Random House, which was a dream that lasted almost 30 years until Random House stopped being Random House. And there I pursued my interest in backlist. I edited the Modern Library series, and when they joined up with Knopf, I edited their Knopf's imitation of my Anchor series called Vintage. And later I became editorial director of the whole company, and for many, many years. One thing I did in 1963, during the newspaper strike, was to start the New York Review of Books, because I felt they needed to be a more sophisticated review medium for sophisticated books than the New York Times was able to produce. So with the help of our neighbors, Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Hardwick, and my wife Barbara, my late wife, we set up the New York Review of Books, and by miracle, Bob Silver was available to edit it, and he still does, and if that's what made it work, that's why it has gone on now for all those intervening years. And I'm delighted by it and proud of it and in awe of Bob's genius, something I could never possibly have done. By the middle 70s, maybe early 80s, I noticed that the backlist were declining very rapidly.
When you say declining, do you mean in sales or just the number?
Disappearing, going out of print. And at first I didn't know why this was happening, but in retrospect I saw what the problems were. One of them was a change in the tax law. Originally in connection with a nut and bolt company, I think, but it affected all manufacturing companies. It did not permit unsold inventory to be written off as an expense.
Right, I remember that. That you had to, that the inventory carries on your books.
Yeah, as an asset.
As an asset, and therefore is taxed as if it was income.
You don't get a deduction for it. Right. It's not an expense, right? So we had to... Random House was a small enough company and run by its editors for the most part, but not so small that some inventory clerk didn't run through our inventory without even knowing what those books were. And
so it made a decision to cut the inventory.
Cut that. Right. And did it entirely on the basis of sales. And we lost some very important authors as a result of that. The other reason was more serious, and that is the shift from city to suburb, the demographic shift, the great independent bookstores, which made up the basis of our market, that could carry 50, 60, 100,000 backlist titles, were disappearing, like the great 8th Street bookstore in Manhattan, for example.
Ted Willens and Eli.
There's only one left in town now, Strand. And maybe across the country, 500, maybe 1,000, depending upon where you want to start counting, were disappearing and being replaced by shopping mall stores, Walden and Dalton. And they're paying the same rent as the shoe store next door. They needed the same turnover. And then that became the age of the bestseller. That now began, the industry now turned upside down, whereas it previously had depended upon backlist for year in, year out stability. Now it had to gamble what seemed to publishers enormous sums, and turned out eventually to become enormous sums, for potential bestsellers at the expense of backlist. That literally did turn the industry upside down and made it a rather disagreeable situation for me. I didn't like that. To offset this, in the middle 80s, I created something called the Reader's Catalog, which was a telephone directory-sized annotated list of some 40,000 backlist titles that you could order over an 800 number. This was before the internet became commercialized. And it was a huge success. We sold, oh, heaven knows how many of those catalogs and many, many, many more times of the books. But handling individual orders, the average order is about $32, was impossible. And so the more books we sold, the more money we lost. And I called this to the attention of my financial backers, who were nice people who didn't understand what I was doing. And I said, well, we can do something about this. We can go online. Now the internet is here. If we put this online, we're going to increase our sales a lot. And you're going to lose tens of millions of dollars until we find a way to deal with the inventory problem. We may never find it. So they said, well, we'd rather not do that. And my main interest is not in being a businessman, it's finding solutions to problems. Let someone else take the business. So we auctioned the Reader's Catalog off between Barnes & Noble and Amazon, deciding not to do it ourselves. And I wasn't disappointed by that, because something else had come up, and that was digitization at about that time. And I remember hearing the word disintermediation for the first time, and I said, well, with that, you can bypass the whole industry. You don't need anything. You don't need warehouses. You need inventory. You need bookstores for another reason, but they're not going to be essential in this format. We want to keep them because they're what they are. But you can now digitize every book ever written in every language and make it available anywhere in the world. The click of a mouse, whatever they had in those days. And that was a revolutionary possibility. That meant that the Gutenberg age, with all of its infrastructure, was over. It was only a matter of time before that was replaced. Oh, I forgot to mention that I started the Library of America, too, in the midst of all this, but that's...
fairly significant thing that you did. there is a theme in your work, obviously.
I like to do books like that. So then... then I gave a series of three lectures at the public library in 1999, the year I retired from the book business, or rather the book business retired out from under me, because there was no book business left, in my opinion. Just gambling on those bestsellers, which I hated the idea of that. And I described what I thought the digital future would be. I said there's one component that has to be invented, everything else seems to be available, and that is a device that turns the digital file into an actual book, an ATM for books. And I published that lecture in the New York Review, and someone called up and said, I know there is such a machine, someone has invented one, he lives in St. Louis, you can go see it, and I did. And it was a big clunky thing, which barely fit in this room. But it did what I said it had to do.
Right, essentially data in, book out.
That's it. I brought him a copy of my the book in which those lectures were printed, a hardcover copy that Norton published, and he took it away. 5 minutes later, came back from his back room where the machine was with a paperback. So I said, well, this will complete the revolution that's going on in the publishing business, but not today and not tomorrow, so you'll hear from me, but not now. They went away. And we kept in touch. Not an easy man to deal with. Nice guy, but difficult. And then one day, about 5 years ago, I happened to say to a neighbor of mine, Dan Miller, who had been a venture capitalist and ended up running Tina DeLuca in that capacity and took it out of bankruptcy and made it work a little bit. But I was then tired of it, that you might go look at this machine and see if that suggests anything to you. So he did and came back and said, well, let's do it. And now we have a corporation called On-Demand Books. We're building these machines not one by one by hand, in effect, because we're not manufacturing them yet. There are 30 or 40 of them around the world. Egypt, Australia, London, Canada, United States. And they're in effect prototypes of what I suspect will be a much larger number eventually. We have a joint venture with Xerox to market and service and produce the machine.
But they're going to sell them now.
They're going to sell them. Well, one of the problems is that we could never possibly service them with our my friend Dan and me, something goes wrong in Canberra and we've got a problem. We have a guy who goes, but it's expensive.
Right.
But Xerox is all over the world. So that solves that problem.
Right. So, and does Xerox share your vision of this machine as potentially providing a point of sale for trade books, or are they thinking of it in other ways?
Oh, other ways as well.
Yeah,
I mean, they certainly see its applications in books and libraries and so on, because they did have that book factory thing.
Sure, and they have sell a lot of high speed digital machine. They have a finishing system. Yeah. They had their own DocuText, all that stuff.
So, And this is, to use their words, the best finishing unit that exists in this size.
Just curious, how many books can a, and your machines are called Espresso still. Mm-hmm. You haven't changed the name?
They'll be called Xerox Espresso.
Xerox Espresso. How many books can one of those machines turn out in an hour, including binding? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah. The high-speed printer that we use, and the duplex high-speed printer we use with Xerox, will print 320 pages a minute. No, 120 pages a minute, I'm sorry. So in 3 minutes, you'll have an average book.
Right. And that includes the bindery?
No, then the bindery takes another minute and a half. Okay. So basically 5 or 6 minutes.
Right, 5 minutes to produce.
And if you set up a train, they'll go through at that speed.
So 10 or 12 books an hour, conceivably.
If there aren't breakdowns and so on, sometimes they put the paper in. That can be done. Right. It has been done.
They use sheet-fed paper?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Maybe eventually you could do it with a web, but I can't quite see why.
Yeah, it's less efficient for handling on the input side.
Well, who knows how it'll evolve? There's some interest, for example, in using a color version of that in museums, so that people who go around looking at pictures can come out at the end with a book of their favorite pictures, with their name on the cover and so on.
Right, the personalized book.
I mean, every day something new pops up.
Right.
We've made a deal with China, licensed them to manufacture and sell the machine in China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. And in exchange, they're going to digitize their titles and make them available to us for worldwide distribution.
And so you maintain a repository of digital titles that are available?
Well, we don't keep them in the machine. We have access to them. Someone has them in the server.
Right. So you can have a local server that's essentially, it's a business unto itself, creates books right there, does not necessarily link out to all of the other, it's not a network of nodes, in other words.
No. I see the future of this. Google will probably be will probably own the great universal multilingual directory. I mean, somebody will have to own that, and Google looks as if it's going to be the outfit that'll do it. From which books can be ordered. Each of them will have its own rights, complexity, but there'll be software for all that stuff. But I think also, individual authors will have their own websites. Publishers will have their websites. And there'll be websites of special interest, and publishers will publish into those. I think the future publishing company will be small groups of like-minded editors with a specialty. Maybe they'll specialize in Brook Trout or Derby Hats or something. And their website, if they're doing well at that, will be become well known to people interested in those things, and that's where they'll find their books.
So, which is a sort of a vision of communities around ideas, publishing as part of a community.
I think so.
And do you think that, I mean, and there's a localism factor in that as well, or effect, where I know some of the places where your machine has been installed, the most produced books are local authors.
Yeah. Like Northshire.
Yeah. And there's one in New Jersey, I think you have.
There is, and there's one in Harvard Square.
Right. And I've talked to them, and I know those, the Harvard Square bookstore people. And I think it's a great store. And I think they, you know, it's a great community. It's a literary and intellectual community.
Everybody has a manuscript in that town.
That's right. And so, the sense, it changes the definition of how a book is published. Right. And, of course, ironically, I think since your background is very much in the traditional editorial concept, I think you're now talking about a real reversal of roles in some cases. Because, and of course, this is the question that people ask all the time: what happens to the editor? You know, if I can walk into a store with my book and no one tells me that it's no good, or no one helps me make it better, and I'll print it. There's, you know, we've disintermediated the editorial process, which may be fine,
Well, you have and you haven't, because, as I say, editors will, I think the publishing companies of the future will be very much like what Random House was when I first went there in the 50s. that was run by its, there were 10 or 12 editors. That was it. It was an art director. There was a publicity person. Bennett was never there. His partner, Donald, had nothing to do. Because everything happened, seemed to happen by itself. You know, it ran well. And there was no one to tell us what to do. We made all the decisions.
So you think that that can be replicated on these sort of nodular...
That's all you need. The editor in the publishing company is everything. Without it, you don't have a publishing company.
Right.
You can have all the infrastructure in the world. You can be like Bertelsmann with the piling one thing on top of another. Unless the editors are good and are left alone to do their work, it's not going to happen.
So do you think this sort of new vision of how it will work, that it actually makes it better than what we have in some of the structures today?
Oh, much. All you need is an editor. Now, there are other people who will not be able to attract an editor for whatever reason, and they used to be called the slush pile, now they're called self-publishers, and they'll do that, and some of them will turn out to be okay. I mean, there might be a future Dreiser out there, someone like that,
mm-hmm.
who might not have found an editor.
Right. Well, if you think back to the 30s, which I often do, there were lots of incredible writers who were not published, or who were published fugitively. I discovered one the other day, now I can't even remember his name, but somebody at New Directions uncovered this guy. He'd been a writer, then chose to go into a business and stopped writing, but he had written enough.
Well, that'll happen again. And booksellers, bookstores, retail bookstores will become publishers too. They'll learn how to do it.
Yeah. Well, they always have had the ability. They just didn't have the means.
Well, now the means are simple. You have a manuscript. You make it into a digital file. You put it up in the air somewhere, and people will either download it and read it on their gadgets, or they'll do it on one of our machines.
I think in a lot of ways, you know, I lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, for a few years in the 70s, and the Minneapolis-St. Paul publishing, writing, bookselling scene of the 70s, 80s, and 90s kind of feels to me like an example of what you're talking about, that it was a community of pretty strong individuals and making up a community that talked among themselves about mm-hmm. writing and books and produced some tremendous writers and attracted other writers to come. And maybe that's sort of a way that the machinery interacts with the community.
And look, we published it, one of them, a Devil Day, had a funny name. Kind of two Finnish-sounding names that sounded exactly the same. I forget what his name was. But he wrote a novel a year first. Anyway, it's all going to be different, and it's going to be, because it's everything human has its ups and downs, it's going to have problems too, but... it's going to be a very exciting publishing scene, I think.
So in that context, since seemingly almost everybody in the book business has e-reading on their minds at this point, and maybe...
That's missing the point of what this is all about.
Well, tell me, in what way do you mean?
Well, I say from the creative point of view, not from the gadget you're reading it on, what you can do with it. They're blinded by the gadget dream. Sometimes I look at this blog by Peter Brantley, and know what it is, and all they talk about is that. You would assume they don't know what a book is. I hate to say something disrespectful, because they're nice people, I'm sure, but they think only of the gadget. They don't see what the real implications are here. When you consider what changes Gutenberg brought into the world with his machine.
Well, but because technology is very difficult to understand when it's brand new, it takes a while for people to figure out how to use it.
There's no reason not to talk about technology, but this is not the main issue of this revolution that's going on right now. This is a cultural revolution. God knows what size this is going to turn into.
No, I think that's true. I think there's an interaction between the culture and the idea and the technology.
No question, as it was with Gutenberg. But I feel there's no... what I lack in these blogs and in the writing, and I said, I see. There's no feeling for what books are, what quality is, what they mean, what someone like Keats actually did.
Well, that's maybe the attention of people is now on the machinery and on the technology, but I think there are people who are trying to figure out how writing and reading will change. And of course, there are writers who, it's always really about writers.
It won't change. It hasn't changed since the Iliad. It's not going to start now.
It's always going to be about stories and storytelling.
And there's a certain quality it has to achieve, and not everybody can do that. That's a very special thing. It's like being able
But the form changes. The form changes a lot.
Literary form has been extremely stable for 5,000 years. We still use the same versification that Shakespeare was using. We use largely the same vocabulary. Novels have much the same structure they've always had. And there can be... You can put music to them and then they become operas, or you can put pictures with them and they become movies. But narrative and verse, I think, are very stable.
Do you think they will be changed by...
What?
That's actually a really interesting point, that if the narrative is fairly constant. You know, in cultural change, core values change the slowest, the more superficial things change the fastest. But how will narrative be affected by the ability of different technologies to marry up other forms with it? I think storytelling is still storytelling, but I wonder about that.
What can you do? You can, as I said, you can add music and have an opera. You can add pictures and have a movie. I mean, these categories exist. They have existed for years, and you can probably do them faster or more complexity with this technology. But there's nothing new in putting pictures together with words. Or music, or three-dimensional. It's pop-up books. I mean, it's everything. There's nothing new is going to happen there. Iambic pentameter is going to remain iambic pentameter.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's actually right, and it's probably fair to say that I still think this, that it's the writing is overall always the measure. And that it's the interaction between the writer and the reader that matters. So the form that happens in doesn't matter.
It doesn't tend to change. I mean, we're not when we write a novelty, we're doing something rather like the Odyssey. I mean, that's just kind of that's the form the novels take. They still do that. Something happens. Someone goes away. He gets lost. He comes back. What happened?
Right.
You know, it's a
right. There's still only a few basic stories.
I mean, how much can you do?
That's true.
But I mean, you can do it wonderfully. There's a young Pakistani American kid. That kid is 35, I guess now. And the Clear Blue Sky has written the most amazing collection of short stories.
What do you remember his name?
I do, but I can't pronounce.
We're going to get the book now because I think it's important. It's still important that the book or the story and the person who wrote it are at the heart of what we do. It's the book is called In Other Rooms, Other Wonders, Danielle Muin Udine.
Capote's title.
Looks like a beautiful book.
Well, it's I picked it up, not expecting an awful lot, and I was just bowled over by it.
Well, see, I think that's always that's the beauty of books, is that there is always someone writing something great that you haven't found yet.
And they're going to go on doing that until the last person drops.
I don't think that will end.
That's not going to change.
No, that stays. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been David Wilk for Publishing Talks, talking to Jason Epstein. Thank you so much for spending the time.
My pleasure.